for this faith. Chapter 13. Intelligent Design and Information Theory. Intelligent design became an informal movement about 25 years ago. In 1990, the lawyer and Darwin skeptic Norman Macbeth unexpectedly received in the mail a manuscript from the UC Berkeley law professor Philip E. Johnson. He questioned Darwinism in much the same way that Macbeth had in his book, Darwin Retried. Not long after that, Johnson's manuscript was published as Darwin on Trial, 1991. It's convenient to think of the intelligent design, ID movement, as beginning with that book. Some of ID's leading researchers soon joined Philip Johnson and gave him their full support. Here are seven in alphabetical order. Michael Behe, William Dembski, David Klinghoffer, Stephen Meyer, Paul A. Nelson, Richard Sternberg, and Jonathan Wells. Today, many more names could be added. Discovery Institute also opened its doors in 1991. Others say that claims about intelligent design began earlier, in the 1980s. The atheist astronomer Fred Hoyle used the term in 1982, and in 1984, three scientists, Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson, published The Mystery of Life's Origin. They argued for an intelligent cause behind the origin of the information in DNA. In 1861, Charles Darwin referred to intelligent design, but in a way that Richard Dawkins surely would have liked and admired. Here's Darwin. "One cannot look at this universe with all living productions and man without believing that all has been intelligently designed. Yet when I look to each individual organism, I can see no evidence of this." And here's Dawkins. "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." In The Origin of Species, Darwin did not address the problem of how life began, beyond saying that it was breathed into some primordial form. Later, in an 1871 letter to his friend J.D. Hooker, he said that life may have begun in a warm little pond. Darwin's allies have basically accepted that because they don't have anything better to offer. To this day, the origin of life remains a mystery. No one has been able to create life, whether in a warm little pond or in a test tube. But not for lack of trying. Nita Sahai, a professor at the University of Akron and an origin of life researcher, listed some of the types of molecules that would have to be coordinated to form life, including, as she put it, 4 nucleotides, 20 amino acids, a few lipids, several clays, and other minerals. In a 2014 lecture entitled The Origins of Life, From Geochemistry to Biochemistry, she called the task of getting just the right components to form life in a lab a combinatorial nightmare. Then she said, "We need to use intelligent design. Oops, she almost invoked the forbidden theory. She was quickly rescued by another professor who told her to say, "careful selection." So she changed the wording. "We need to carefully select which nucleotides to start with, which amino acids and minerals." As this intervention suggests, intelligent design has become unmentionable in biology departments, except as something to deny, disdain, or attack. I shall say more about biologists' hostility to the very idea of intelligent design later in this chapter. Meanwhile, it is more than reasonable to maintain that the origin of life did indeed require intelligent design. No one yet has been able to explain that origin without design. When Ben Stein asked Richard Dawkins in the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, how life began, Dawkins said that he had no idea, and neither did anyone else. Late in the day. One might say that, for those who dispute Darwinism, intelligent design theory came along late in the day. One explanation is that an effective critique of Darwinism can be mounted without relying on intelligent design, just as Macbeth did in Darwin Retried. Furthermore, ID, in its recent incarnation, has largely depended on the discovery of DNA and its details in the 1950s and 1960s. Nonetheless, intelligent design adds considerably to the case against neo-Darwinism. It confronts the theory with huge improbabilities that Darwin himself could not have foreseen. Random DNA change is the only mechanism at the Darwinists' disposal, so they must either abandon their creed or accept that highly improbable events routinely occur within the cell. Recall that Darwin and his contemporaries had no way of knowing just how complex a cell is. Today, it is sometimes compared to a high-tech factory. But a cell is far more complex than that. For one thing, factories can't replicate themselves. Meanwhile, we are repeatedly told that ID can't be right because Darwinian evolution is a fact. But we can search in vain for facts that establish the truth of the theory. Natural selection? It cannot create new species. Instead, it works in the Darwinian mind as a magic wand that makes problems disappear as easily as a magician's props. Further, natural selection is not available as a mechanism until the first replicating cell has appeared. Common descent is a deduction from Darwin's theory, but it has never been demonstrated. Homology is a fact of nature, but it is also common in human design. Organisms are observed to vary about a mean, but never to depart indefinitely from the original type. And so it goes. But one philosophy has attached itself like a limpet to Darwinism. That is the philosophy of materialism, or naturalism. And it does seem to support the theory. But it turns out that philosophical materialism severely restricts the possibilities of science. In fact, science was long promoted by Christians without any reliance on materialism. In The Genesis of Science, 2011, James Hannum elaborates on his thesis that the Christian Middle Ages launched the scientific revolution. Later, Isaac Newton, a theist, saw that design was necessary in explaining the origin of the solar system's planetary orbits. ID as an inference. Intelligent design is not a deduction from a philosophy, but an inference from observed facts. In everyday life, we make inferences to design all the time. The philosopher William Lane Craig put it this way: a beachcomber who comes upon a sandcastle recognizes that it's not the result of the action of the waves and the wind, but of intelligent design. An archaeologist excavating a site can tell the difference between a human artifact, such as a statue, and an object misshaped due to erosion. Sometimes it can be difficult to make that distinction, as with an early hand axe. But the occasional difficulty does not render the distinction itself invalid. Inferences to design are often made long after the designer has departed from the scene, or whose identity may never be known. Anyone who tried to argue that the image of four U.S. presidents on Mount Rushmore was a product of wind erosion would be judged insane. We know that they were designed, and we know that without necessarily knowing the name of the designer, the number of his assistants, or when or how the carving was done. Stonehenge? We know it was designed thousands of years ago, although we don't know by whom. As for its purpose, that is still uncertain and debated. We have no problem, then, in inferring human design. After all, humans design things every day. But an inference to design in nature, and biology in particular, is contrary to the unwritten rules of contemporary science. Allowing that organisms are designed would take us into forbidden territory. That reminds us of the materialist philosophy that currently presides over science, even though its role is often inexplicit. In a purely materialistic universe, design is impossible. In such a world, all we have are colliding atoms and molecules. Matter, on a materialistic theory, creates mind. Philip Johnson once allowed that evolution is the most plausible explanation for life if you're using naturalistic terms or materialistic philosophy. Why should our everyday judgments about design be suspended in the case of living organisms? Because admitting design in biology would immediately overthrow Darwin's theory. Its whole thrust from the beginning was to eliminate the need for a designer, to persuade us that nature could construct organisms without any input from a designer. That is precisely what natural selection was supposed to have achieved. But of course it didn't. In order to find out what or who its designer is, said Thomas Woodward, a historian of intelligent design, one must go outside the narrow discipline of biology. Irreducible complexity. In Darwin's Black Box, 1996, Lehigh University's Michael Behe drew attention to the irreducible complexity of the bacterial flagellum, a molecular machine that drives bacteria through fluids. The removal of a single segment of the flagellum immobilizes the whole thing. Behe's description of irreducible complexity was a key moment in the development, or should I say the evolution, of the ID movement. Much has been made of the flagellum because of Behe's expert knowledge of the topic, but many other body parts have diverse components and are also irreducibly complex. Darwinism requires that bodies be built one small step at a time. But Behe argued that the flagellum could not have been constructed that way. He used a mousetrap to explain why not. It will not catch any mice until all its parts are connected correctly. A solitary spring that is part of a mousetrap will not catch a single mouse. Analogously, the bacterial flagellum will not work until all of its parts are properly in place. Part of a flagellum will not propel a bacterium slowly. It won't propel it at all. But Darwin's theory obliges us to accept that complex structures are assembled piecemeal, each piece conferring an advantage over its predecessor. In the Darwinian scheme, the organism also must be capable of surviving at each incremental stage. It's as though General Motors was obliged to construct automobiles in such a way that they could be driven both before and after each major component was added on an assembly line. Loyal Darwinians, such as Kenneth Miller of Brown University, have tried to hold the line. By the logic of irreducible complexity, he wrote, the component parts of the flagellum should have no function until all those parts are put into place, which is not what Behe claimed. Miller pointed to one part in particular, the type 3 secretory system, which exists both inside the flagellum and separately outside it. Therefore, it didn't depend on the flagellum to work. In his response, Behe pointed out that Miller wasn't thinking clearly. To simplify, a number of functioning parts have to be inside a box if it is to work. Miller then found a part inside the box that also existed outside the box. In his criticism, Behe compared the secretory system to a pump. Suppose I said that a car was irreducibly complex because it needed wheels, a motor, and chassis. Later it was discovered that a car also has a fuel pump. Miller's position is like saying the car is not irreducibly complex because the fuel pump can exist outside the car and work as a standalone pump. But that doesn't say how a functioning car can be put together without a fuel pump. The car still requires all those parts. Miller's argument doesn't even say where the fuel pump came from. In short, the flagellum resists the standard Darwin variety explanation. As it cannot function with a part missing, it is reasonable to infer that it was assembled all at once, and that implies design. Notice, this is not the same as claiming that God created the flagellum, or any other part. Such a conclusion is derived from a theistic premise, where the designer is posited at the outset. Intelligent design theory, then, does not identify a designer, any more than we can identify the designer of Stonehenge. Complex specified information. It is unexceptionable that intelligent causes can do things which unintelligent causes cannot, said the mathematician and philosopher William Dembski, at the time a senior fellow at Discovery Institute. In 1996, he published his explanatory filter, yielding an inference to design. The explanatory filter proceeds by eliminating events or structures that cannot be regarded as designed, because they are products either of chance or necessity. It's true that necessary or law-like events are not designed. Consider a stone that is washed off a cliff. Its landing place can be predicted, and its path described mathematically. But its landing place cannot be considered to be intelligently designed. It is law-like, a product of gravity and Newton's laws of motion. Some might say that the law of gravity was itself designed by the creator of the universe, but that introduces an unnecessary complication that can, for our purpose here, be ignored. Next in the filter, we turn to chance. Chance events are obviously not designed. A randomly chosen sequence of, say, 20 or more letters of the alphabet is highly complex and improbable. It would take a very long time to reproduce it by a random method, by throwing down Scrabble pieces, for example. But the problem here is that any sequence of 20 letters is as improbable as any other. Improbability alone does not entail design. Every bridge hand ever dealt is improbable, and it would take a dealer a long time to replicate a given hand. But it is erroneous to see something as designed merely because reproducing it by random means would be time-consuming. A random sequence of 20 or so letters, or numbers, does contain a high level of information. But that refers to information as measured by the MIT theorist Claude Shannon. The problem is that Shannon's theory cannot distinguish functional or message-bearing sequences from random or useless ones, as Stephen Meyer said in Signature in the Cell. Message-bearing does not appear until a particular sequence is specified. What does that mean? Consider a well-known sequence of letters. In the beginning was the Word. That series of letters and spaces is neither a product of law nor random. It corresponds to a sentence found independently of any procedure for randomly aligning letters. So it is specified. It is also complex. It would take a long time to reach that sequence from St. John's Gospel by throwing down letters randomly. So it is both complex and specified. From that, we can infer that it was designed. Generalizing from this, William Dembski formulated the law of small probability. Specified events of small probability do not occur by chance. Going from the sublime to the mundane, an argument reminiscent of Dembski's was made by Ian Fleming in his James Bond book, Goldfinger. At one point, the villain said, "Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action." Goldfinger understood that someone, James Bond, was targeting him. His inference to enemy action was also an inference to design. Intelligent design in the body. Complex specified information is what is conveyed or represented by a particular arrangement or sequence of things. In biology, it can be thought of as analogous to software code, instructions for a new computer program. DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created, Bill Gates once said. In the same way, DNA contains a set of instructions used in the assembly of proteins. Darwin's geologist friend Charles Lyell said that in trying to understand events in the remote past, we should look for causes now in operation. Mind satisfies that requirement. In fact, mind is the only known cause of the kind of sequence-specific code that we see in biology. Improbabilities, questionable in bridge hands, really do arise when sequences are specified. Along the DNA molecule, we find a long string of nucleotides, signified by the four letters A, C, G, and T. Their sequence along the DNA backbone at first may seem to be random, just as the sequence of letters in an English sentence might appear random to someone who knows nothing about the English language. But we now know that nucleotides form sequences that the genetic code uses to construct proteins. Proteins, in turn, are highly specified, complex structures found all over the animal kingdom. Nucleotides convey information by virtue of their sequence, not their chemical properties. In other words, the desired sequence is specific. DNA is like written language in that respect. Both SALT and LAST contain the same four letters, but convey different meanings based on their sequence alone. The sequence hypothesis was first proposed in 1958 by Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. The hypothesis states that the sequence of bases in the genetic material determines the sequence of amino acids for which that segment of DNA codes. Crick also thought that the amino acid sequence, in turn, determines the three-dimensional structure into which proteins fold. How rare are the functional sequences among those that are possible in an amino acid chain of a given length? Even by 1966, 8 years after Crick's proposal, not enough was known about molecular biology to answer that question. But a postdoctoral researcher at Cambridge named Douglas Axe was able to find some answers. If we are talking about sequences of 150 amino acids capable of folding into function-ready structures compared to all possible sequences of that length, Axe determined the ratio to be 1 to 10 to the 74th power. Axe told Steve Meyer that the odds of finding a functional protein by random mutation are far lower than the odds of finding a given atom out of all the atoms in our galaxy. The underlying problem is that the 20 relevant amino acids can be assembled in trillions of ways, yet the vast majority of those sequences will not cause proteins to fold correctly, and proteins which do not fold correctly will not function. Many necessary proteins in cells require numerous amino acids linked in sequence. Most genes, sections of DNA that code for a specific protein, consist of at least 1,000 nucleotide bases, Meyer wrote. That corresponds to 4 to the 1,000th power possible base sequences of that length. An unimaginably large number. Further, proteins typically require hundreds of amino acids in order to perform their functions. Participants at the Y-Star Institute conference in Philadelphia saw this as a problem as long ago as 1966. They understood the immensity of the combinatorial space associated with proteins of merely average length. They realized, Meyer continued, that if the mutations themselves were truly random, that is, if they were neither directed by an intelligence nor influenced by the functional needs of the organism, as neo-Darwinism stipulates, then the probability of the mutation and selection mechanism ever producing a new gene or protein could well be vanishingly small. Discovery Institute's Jonathan Wells points out that the improbability problem is not confined to the first cell. New protein folds would have to originate throughout the history of life, not just with the first cell, said Wells. Even in the early history of bacteria, many new proteins would have been needed. Yet the origin of even one functional protein by a Darwinian mechanism is so unlikely that the odds are effectively zero. So the question is, if chance is the only permissible agent of change, how did the specified sequences appear in the DNA in the first place? The answer is that the cell, and along with it, the DNA molecule, must have been intelligently designed. No known undirected chemical process can produce the information necessary to account for the origin of the first living cell, or any later cell or system. A professor of microbiology at the University of Chicago, James Shapiro, wrote in 1996 that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations. Just as computer code comes from programmers, so functional information in the cell comes from intelligence. It comes from mind, not from matter. Entrenched hostility to ID. In preferring intelligent to mechanistic cause, intelligent design theory is in direct competition with the dominant evolutionary theory of biological origins, neo-Darwinism. So it has faced much opposition. A good example is found in Wikipedia's lengthy article on ID. It begins, "Intelligent design, ID, is the pseudo-scientific view that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection." Numerous attempts have been made to change such derogatory comments, but all such changes are promptly reversed on Wikipedia, sometimes within minutes. Leonard Krishtaka, a biologist and director of the University of Kansas Museum of Natural History, has said that design can't be measured. Therefore, it is a religious belief and science has no comment on that. He might have added that complex specified information can be measured and has been found to be wildly improbable absent design. He might also have said that macroevolution has not yet been measured or so much as observed. The pretense that it has depends on extrapolation, from which valid scientific conclusions can be drawn only tentatively and with numerous caveats. In 2005, on the front page of the Washington Post, Barry Lynn, the director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, said that intelligent design is merely a veneer over a certain theological message, thus falsely identifying ID with religion. When he was at Baylor University, Dembski formed the Polanyi Institute to debate these issues, with Darwinians and ID opponents included on the board. But the institute was shut down after vehement protests from Baylor's biology faculty. They did not want ID to be so much as discussed. Darwinians today are eager to stick their own labels onto ID. Intelligent design creationism is one favorite. It's as though an unseen collective voice had cried out, "Give us back our preferred enemy, bring back creationism, that we knew how to respond to." But so far, no intelligent rebuttal of intelligent design has appeared. A privileged planet. Intelligent design also arose as a contentious issue after publication of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. The book, by Guillermo Gonzalez and J. W. Richards, Regnery Books, 2004, challenged the Copernican principle, the idea that there is nothing special about Earth or its place in the universe. The authors replaced the Copernican principle with the anthropic principle. The claim that had the physical parameters of the universe been slightly different, we wouldn't be here to observe it. The implication is that intelligent life requires the existence of a cosmos of quite a specific level of complexity, said Steve Fuller. And that level of complexity borders on the miraculous, unless, of course, it was somehow purpose-made. A faculty member at the University of Warwick, Steve Fuller was appointed to a chair in social epistemology in 2011. The presence of essential elements on Earth, particularly carbon, oxygen, and water in the right proportions, led to the claim by Gonzalez and Richards that the planet was designed for multicellular organic life. One reviewer of the book pointed out that bringing together the conditions for life as we know it is so complex that advanced life may be exceedingly rare. Extraterrestrial life remains elusive despite a great deal of searching. So the idea that ours is a privileged planet still has not been refuted. Gonzalez and Richards went further and said that the universe itself, not just our place in it, was designed for discovery. They maintain, for example, that Earth and the Moon work together to sustain earthly life as one intricate system, producing the best solar eclipses available to earthly observers. They also claimed that Jupiter and Saturn protect Earth from cataclysmic destruction. What happened next was perhaps more interesting than the claims in the book. Gonzalez, an assistant research professor of astronomy at Iowa State University, and the author of over 60 peer-reviewed scientific articles, including articles in Nature and Science and a Scientific American cover story, was refused tenure in 2007. The problem was that he had invoked intelligent design. This was too much for faculty members, and not just at Iowa State University. Over 400 professors across the state signed various statements opposing all attempts to represent intelligent design as a scientific endeavor, both on and outside the planet. Whether in astronomy or biology, the professors insisted, the philosophy of naturalism is expected to enjoy a monopoly. Any alternative claim was rejected as unscientific. William H. Jeffries, a professor of astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, spoke for many in the academy. He said in a review of The Privileged Planet that, "What is new in this book isn't interesting, and what is old is just old hat creationism in a new modern-looking astronomical costume." In 2013, Guillermo Gonzalez joined the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Ball State University in Indiana. He told members of the department that he would continue his research on astrobiology and stellar astrophysics. "I will not be discussing intelligent design, ID, in my classes. I didn't discuss ID at Iowa State University either." He reiterated his view that evidence of design in cosmology is not out of the mainstream, and a number of cosmologists and physicists hold to this view. He also said that he was denied tenure at Iowa State not because of poor academics on my part, but for ideological and political reasons. Chapter 14. Darwin and the Philosophy of Materialism. Stephen Jay Gould once pointed out that Darwin had worked out his theory of evolution by 1837, but didn't go public with it until 1858. What caused the delay? It wasn't that he was incapacitated. During that time, he wrote a 4-volume treatise on barnacles. In his autobiography, he doubted whether barnacles had been worth the time he spent on them. Gould argued that 2 of Darwin's notebooks, written in 1838 and 1839, contain the answer. Evolution itself wasn't the problem. Earlier in the 19th century, it was a very common heresy, widely and openly discussed. Darwin's own grandfather had broached the subject. The problem was that Darwin's theory was distinguished from all the others by its unremitting materialism, then considered to be a greater heresy than evolution itself. Previous essays on evolution were softened by a reliance on vital forces, organic striving, teleology, and the like. In contrast, Darwin's theory conformed to full-blown materialism, encompassing what he termed the citadel itself. That was the human mind. He argued that the mind was nothing but a special configuration of matter. Gould defined materialism as the claim that matter is the stuff of all existence, and the claim that all mental and spiritual phenomena are its byproducts. No notion could be more upsetting to the deepest traditions of Western thought than the statement that mind, however complex and powerful, is simply a product of brain. To be acceptable to his contemporaries, then, Darwin's theory needed a climate of opinion more favorable to materialism. That did not quite exist in the 1830s. But by 1860, the required liberalization had occurred. Earlier in the 19th century, Materialism had been actively repressed. Lectures were proscribed, publication hampered, professorships denied, and according to the editor of the early Darwin notebooks, fierce invective and ridicule of materialism appeared in the press. Scholars and scientists learned the lesson and responded to the pressures on them. Sometimes they recanted, and sometimes they published anonymously, or delayed publication for many years. In one of those notebooks, Darwin reminded himself to avoid stating how far I believe in materialism, and to say only that emotions, instincts, and so on are so because brain of child resembles parent stock. In another notebook, Darwin mocked himself. Love of the deity effect of organization, oh you materialist. Stephen C. Dilley, a philosopher at St. Edward's University in Texas and a student of Darwin's writings, showed that Darwin did not deploy materialism, sometimes called naturalism, consistently in The Origin. Instead, he strategically and progressively invoked it in the 6 editions of The Origin in order to enhance the persuasiveness of his theory and to marginalize special creation from the scientific discussion. Alex Rosenberg, head of the philosophy department at Duke University and a committed naturalist, described his position this way. What is the world really like? It's fermions and bosons, atomic particles, and everything that can be made up of them, and nothing that can't be made up of them. All the facts about fermions and bosons determine or fix all the other facts about reality and what exists in this universe or any other if, as physics may end up showing, there are other ones. Kai Nielsen, a professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of Calgary, reinforced Rosenberg. Naturalism denies that there are any spiritual or supernatural realities. But the UC Berkeley philosopher John Searle viewed the subject more critically. There is a sense in which materialism is the religion of our time, at least among most of the professional experts in the fields of philosophy, psychology, cognitive science, and other disciplines that study the mind. Like more traditional religions, it is accepted without question, and it provides the framework within which other questions can be posed, addressed, and answered. Notice that if full-blown materialism is true, then Darwin's theory of common descent must also be true. Complex organisms do exist, after all, so atoms and molecules in motion must have somehow whirled themselves into the far more complex structures that we see around us, whether bacterial or human. That also necessitates a finely graded series of structures that gradually and progressively evolve themselves from bits and pieces of molecules into life, bacteria, and so on. We don't need to bring natural selection into the discussion. Armed with his creed, the true believing materialist no longer needs to study evolution in any detail. Phylogeny? Fossils? Cell structure? Who needs them? The materialist can simply retort, we have the starting point, molecules in motion. We have the end point, us. And given that only physical matter exists, how else could such a progression have happened except by a protracted series of parent-offspring stages? At that point, Darwinism becomes little more than a deduction from a philosophy. The science is redundant. There is no need to bother with information theory, enumerate mutations, whether favorable or unfavorable, or fuss about fossils. Darwin's theory is embedded in its underlying materialism. Natural selection, meanwhile, resembles gears disconnected from the engine. It operates as a convenient cover story, seeming to dissolve all the intervening improbabilities. As we already saw in Chapter 5, the best statement of the commitment to materialism was made by Harvard's Richard Lewontin in the New York Review of Books, 1997. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Philip E. Johnson, the founder of the intelligent design movement, commented, "Lewontin is telling us that scientific materialists like himself, we, don't believe in materialism because they are convinced by the broad claims of evolution. Rather, it is the other way around. They believe that the entire history of life can be explained by materialistic processes, evolution, because of their prior commitment to materialism." Most academics today share that commitment. A leading example is Tufts University's Daniel Dennett. In Consciousness Explained, 1991, he wrote, "The prevailing wisdom, variously expressed and argued for, is materialism. There is only one sort of stuff, namely matter, the physical stuff of physics, chemistry, and physiology, and the mind is somehow nothing but a physical phenomenon." In Darwin's Dangerous Idea, 1995, he derided any alternative to this philosophy as relying on skyhooks, or a source of design that does not build on lower, simpler layers. Darwinism, on the other hand, relies on cranes, said Dennett, and cranes build from the bottom up. Avowed materialists such as Dennett embrace an ideology. They are the atheistic counterparts to Christians who openly say, "I believe in the Bible and therefore I don't believe in Darwinism." Creationists are easy for materialists to rebut because they can reply, "That is just your belief. We don't accept that because we don't believe in the Bible." In the same way, skeptics can say to the materialists, "That is just your belief. We don't have to accept your philosophy. Furthermore, it is the real basis of your faith in Darwinism." The difference is the premise of what can be accepted as knowledge. Someone who accepts only what can be called scientific evidence must a priori reject everything else. The National Committee of Science Education identified non-natural explanations with miracles and said, whether or not miracles occur, they cannot be part of a scientific explanation. They were right, but failed to demonstrate that miracles cannot occur and so begged the question. Denial of free will. If mind is just a special configuration of brain cells, then mind is nothing but matter. How can neurons decide to do one thing rather than another? They can't. With the mind reduced to matter, we can't decide to do something different. Nerve cells can't make decisions. Therefore, materialism repudiates the freedom of the will. The consistent materialist sees this, denies free will, and dismisses consciousness as a delusion. The best-known Darwinians follow that path and should be commended for their consistency. "Our sense of self is a neuronal illusion," said Jerry Coyne, a fully paid-up materialist and the author of Why Evolution is True. The molecular biologist Francis Crick said the same thing. "Your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. You're nothing but a pack of neurons." Michael Egnor, a neurosurgeon and professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Stony Brook University, replied that certain aspects of the mind, intelligence, and will are inherently immaterial. Therefore, they cannot be yoked to matter deterministically. Thereupon, a defender of the Jerry Coyne position said that such an argument implies that computers can't even work. "For example," wrote the Coyne defender, "how does a computer know that a particular binary string is an ASCII character versus a binary number? For anybody who knows how computers do work, the answer lies in the design of the computer chips, base instruction sets, and how more complex concepts are built from simpler ones." To which Egnor responded, "Your computer doesn't know a binary string from a ham sandwich. Your math book doesn't know algebra. Your Rolodex doesn't know your cousin's address. Your watch doesn't know what time it is. Your car doesn't know where you're driving. Your television doesn't know who won the football game last night. Your cell phone doesn't know what you said to your girlfriend this morning. People know things. Devices like computers and books and Rolodexes and watches and cars and televisions and cell phones don't know anything. They don't have minds. They are artifacts, paper and plastic and silicon things designed and manufactured by people. And they provide people with the means to leverage their human knowledge. The materialist philosophy puts its advocates at odds with the great majority of mankind, alerting the rest of us to the implausibility of what we are expected to believe. Being told that evolution is a fact can be intimidating because many laymen won't know how to respond. But to be told your will is not free, even though you think it is, or you are an automaton and you don't even know it, is likely to get people's backs up. Richard Dawkins has aroused people in this way, and Phil Johnson respects him and Daniel Dennett for doing so. The same applies to the late Cornell biologist William B. Provine, 1943 to 2015. He and Johnson would debate these issues on nationwide tours. Johnson disagreed with Provine intellectually, but respected his consistency and enjoyed his company. Provine outdid everyone in his bluntness. Here is one of his better-known sallies. Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. There are no gods, no purposes, no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I am going to be dead. That's the end for me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning to life, and no free will for humans either. Richard Dawkins made the same claim. Religion teaches the dangerous nonsense that death is not the end. It's interesting to reflect that Dawkins, Provine, and some others may in the end cause more trouble for evolutionism than the theistic evolutionists whose goal in life is to have it both ways. The best-known group of theistic evolutionists is BioLogos, founded by Francis Collins, now the director of the National Institutes of Health. He and others, notably Brown University's Kenneth Miller, embrace both Christianity and Darwinism and see no incompatibility between them. Methodological naturalism. We come now to a distinction contrasting methodological naturalism, MN, with philosophical naturalism, PN. The term methodological naturalism was invented by the Christian philosopher Paul de Vries in the mid-1980s when he was teaching at a Christian institution, Wheaton College. Methodological naturalists argue that Christians don't need to accept full-blown materialism, or PN. The methodological naturalist proceeds as if naturalism is true when doing natural science, without actually believing that naturalism is true. Here is the reasoning. Scientists work only with nature, not with God, souls, etc., and therefore in their work, for all practical purposes, nature can be treated as if it is all that exists. But religious life, ethics, etc., do not have to assume that nature is all that exists. So if the MN/PN distinction is valid, a Christian scientist can be a methodological naturalist all week long in the laboratory, while remaining philosophically non-naturalist outside of the laboratory, at church on Sunday, etc. Thus, theistic evolutionists can be as naturalistic as Darwinians when doing science, while being anti-Darwinian in religion and ethics due to their non-naturalistic beliefs about God, immortality, etc. Methodological naturalism is supported by the National Center for Science Education, the AAAS, the National Academy of Sciences, and by other groups populated mainly by materialists. They don't want to be seen as strident atheists or as bullying their theistic fellow citizens, says Discovery Institute's Paul Nelson. Full-blown materialism invites confrontation and arguments over evidence, arguments which they might lose. Nelson is critical of the MN/PN distinction. He says that methodological naturalism is the polite, apparently inoffensive, seemingly religiously neutral version of materialism. It looks modest, merely promoting observation and testability. It seems to claim we're all good empiricists here, ruling out spooks or occult causes. and that makes it easy to sell to theists who are eager to be seen as reasonable and on board with the science of Darwinism. But its practical consequences, Nelson added, are identical to those of full-blown naturalism. In his book, Darwin's Doubt, Stephen Meyer argues that inferences to intelligent causation, while fully warranted by the evidence of the Cambrian explosion, run afoul of methodological naturalism. Its working assumption, Meyer said, is that all features of the natural world can be explained by material causes without recourse to purposive intelligence, mind, or conscious agency. But its fatal defect is easily seen. If researchers refuse as a matter of principle, namely MN, to consider the design hypothesis, they will obviously miss any evidence that happens to support it. One cannot evaluate the evidence for or against any hypothesis that has been ruled out a priori. For this and other reasons, intelligent design theorists regard MN as an obstacle to knowledge and a rule that should be dispensed with. On the other side, Robert Bishop of BioLogos thinks that MN requires phenomena to be explained solely by material or physical causes. Agency should be restricted to human activities only. An intelligent agent is a presupposition external to cellular and evolutionary biology, and so is brought in from the outside. Intelligent design, which does indeed countenance non-material causation, therefore violates the well-defined boundaries of natural science. At that point, biologists rightly object, Bishop said. But mind itself imports causation from the outside, because it cannot be reduced to matter. This is the argument that Thomas Nagel has eloquently made. Why materialism is almost certainly false. The most prominent recent criticism of materialism has come from Thomas Nagel, a philosopher at New York University. His essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, received a lot of attention and was later reprinted in his Mortal Questions, 1979. His more recent book, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False, 2012, may turn out to be a game-changer. Nagel also expressed support for various scholars associated with the intelligent design movement, including Steve Mayer, Michael Behe, and David Berlinski. It is difficult for diehard materialists to call him a creationist, because he is an atheist. Nagel received a lot of support, a turn of events suggesting that we may be moving back to the pre-materialist intellectual climate of the 1830s. Inadvertently, the philosopher Michael Ruse aided that idea. Initially a Baptist, Ruse spent half his life writing books defending Darwinism and along the way became an atheist. He once told Daniel Dennett that he, Dennett, could be more effective with his materialism if only he were more tactful. Then he compared Thomas Nagel to Sam Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford who debated T.H. Huxley in 1860. Huxley, incidentally, was not a materialist, believing materialism to involve grave philosophical error. In a review of Nagel's book in 2013, the evolutionary geneticist H. Allen Orr wrote, "Consciousness is the most conspicuous obstacle to a comprehensive naturalism that relies only on the resources of physical science. The existence of consciousness seems to imply that the physical description of the universe, in spite of its richness and explanatory power, is only part of the truth, and that the natural order is far less austere than it would be if physics and chemistry accounted for everything." Nagel made the following objection to materialism, or naturalism. Evolutionary naturalism provides an account of our capacities that undermines their reliability, and in doing so, undermines itself. Put another way, if our minds are simply the accidental products of a blind process, what reason do we have for accepting materialistic claims as true? Years ago, C.S. Lewis made the same case in his book, Miracles. A strict materialism refutes itself for the reason long ago given by Professor Haldane, Lewis said, continuing as follows. If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. Lewis added, a theory which explained everything else in the whole universe, but which made it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid, would be utterly out of court, for that theory would itself have been reached by thinking. And if thinking is not valid, that theory would, of course, be demolished. It would have destroyed its own credentials. It would be an argument which proved that no argument was sound, a proof that there are no such things as proofs. Nagel also said that minds convey subjective experiences that are outside the objective world of space and time. So the physical sciences cannot describe such experiences or tell us how the world appears to individuals. Does my red look like your red? How can we know? Nagel, there can be a purely physical description of the neurophysiological processes that give rise to an experience and also of the physical behavior that is typically associated with it. But such a description, however complete, will leave out the subjective essence of the experience, how it is from the point of view of its subject, without which it would not be a conscious experience at all. In short, the physical sciences necessarily leave an important aspect of nature unexplained. That it was even necessary for an eminent philosopher to make such common sense claims shows how deeply embedded materialism has become in our time. Nagel went on to offer criticism of evolutionism, while at the same time distancing himself from creationism. Since the long process of biological evolution is responsible for the existence of conscious organisms, and since a purely physical process cannot explain their existence, it follows that biological evolution must be more than just a physical process, and the theory of evolution, if it is to explain the existence of conscious life, must become more than just a physical theory. In the end, the most sensible position may be to substitute the dualism of René Descartes for the materialism of Darwinism and his followers. Dualism holds that the mind is a non-physical substance, evident to all of us in our conscious experience. Materialism is surely false, to amend Nagel only slightly, but it's a false philosophy with side benefits. It serves to remind us that Darwinism itself is mostly a philosophy dressed up as science. And once the philosophy of materialism is rejected, can Darwinism itself be far behind? Dislodged from its bed of materialism, what is left? Darwin's atheism. Darwin himself was antagonistic to religion, and became ever more so as he aged. In his autobiography, he wrote, "Thus disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress, and have never since doubted, even for a single second, that my conclusion was correct. I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true, for if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all my best friends, will be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine." I shall look more closely at his religious views in Chapter 20. Chapter 15. DNA. God is in the details. For almost 100 years after The Origin was published, living things were studied at the level of limbs or whole organisms. Evolutionists knew little or nothing about the cellular or molecular details. But once they were understood, Darwin's theory ran into difficulties. In this chapter, I shall try to explain why. If an organ could not be formed by numerous successive slight modifications, Darwin wrote in The Origin, his theory would absolutely break down. Natural selection must either work by slight modifications or not at all. Jumps or leaps were not allowed. Then, in Darwin's black box, the biochemist Michael Behe made a case for the irreducible complexity of a particular organ, the bacterial flagellum. That met Darwin's condition. An irreducibly complex organ is one that cannot be formed by successive slight modifications. If so, evolution has been falsified by Darwin's own criterion. Later in this chapter, I shall take a closer look at Behe's flagellum argument. What is undeniable?